Well, it's College Sunday, and it's always a pleasure to be here. It's one of my favorite opportunities to be able to come up in front of the whole church and to teach with you what I've been learning. The last few months, I've been going through Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, all six books, and it's been a great study. It's an interesting study because if you go through 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, you go through a lot of chapters. But as you go through it and you study, you see David's life and how God blessed him in his obedience. But you also see in his disobedience the consequences of that. And you get to see the different kings that will come along, and in their obedience, God blesses the nations and in the nation, and in their disobedience, he punishes them. And in particular, we see the division of the kingdom and the different kings of the north and the kings of the south. And we see faithful men going into these climates of utter sin and proclaiming to return back to Yahweh. It's what I've been really wrestling through and studying. And one man in particular is striking, and that is Isaiah. He is a faithful messenger. Sometimes when you come to the Bible, you don't look at it through the whole Old Testament context, and oftentimes we'll jump in a chapter or a verse or whatever the case may be, and forget that there's a whole backdrop to the book of Isaiah. Isaiah was a prophet who not much is known about him, a little bit, but he ministers for 50-some years, roughly. He serves God. He sees reigns of four different kings in his lifetime, and in the fifth king, Manasseh, he is end up martyred, put in a tree and sawn in half. And in that time, by the time it gets to Manasseh, the nation has just turned away from God completely. But Isaiah is faithful in that context. And he preaches and he preaches and he preaches for roughly about 50 years of his ministry, and very little response, very little return to God. And one of the things that pops out to me is the faithfulness of a man who preaches the same message and no one returns. At least the nation doesn't respond for probably about 50 years. If I was to ask you, would you take a job in which for 50 years you labored and there would be no outward results? Would you take that job? Would you say, hey, a job's a job, and especially in this current predicament we're in, I'll take any job. Would you take a job that says you're going to put in hard, hard work, and at the end of it, you're going to look back, and at least visibly, you're not going to see much? Oftentimes, you hear of different pastors or at least seminary graduates who go out and they want to take a big church, and they have great things in mind, and they're going to just reach the world for Jesus, so to speak. And I wonder, because I ask myself this question: would I go wherever God had asked me to go, knowing ahead of time that there might not be much fruit? Would I go? That's a tough question. And what we see is Isaiah going to a people who are not going to respond to him over and over and over again. So why is he faithful? For 50-some years, why is he faithful? I think Isaiah 6 is going to really help us understand that. But to understand Isaiah 6, we need to understand a few things. Number one, God's promises to his people. Isaiah is in the Old Testament, and Isaiah has a background in the Mosaic Covenant. And to understand Isaiah, and especially to understand Isaiah 6, we need just a brief glimpse of God's promises in the Old Testament, and in particular the Mosaic Covenant. You remember Genesis through Deuteronomy, and the Lord gives his law, his word, his covenant, and the people say, oh, all that you say, we will do. Probably one of the biggest lies in the Old Testament. Everything that you say, we will do. Exodus 24. God promises that if they obey, there will be blessing. But if they disobey, there will be punishment. And so we just want to briefly look at Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 and just what they say. I don't know how Isaiah did it in his time without PowerPoint, but this is a really fast way to get through Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. Because I would encourage you to go back and look at it. But what both of those sections will say is that Israel will be blessed for obedience. They will have rain. They will have prosperity. They will have military success. God will protect them. But he also says that Israel will be punished for disobedience. And that's seen directly in them rejecting God's word. And there are a lot of punishments. If you read Leviticus 26 and 28, there is a famine and there is death and military defeats. And one of the most intriguing is in Deuteronomy, the itch that has no cure. I mean, there's just a number of pestilence and all of these things that come upon them. But the most severe punishment is being exiled. But yet in both of these circumstances, God is going to promise a future restoration. So when we come to Isaiah, we need to understand it in light of what God has already promised to his people. We need to understand that blessings will come through their obedience. But when they reject God, they will be punished. And when they continue to reject God, he will increase the punishments until finally they will be exiled. But when all is said and done, there is a future restoration for them. That is kind of a general overview of them. Well, then we come to Isaiah chapter 1, verse 4, and we see this. They have abandoned the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from him. Let's look at chapter 1 together. We're just going to read a few verses to set the stage. In verse 2 of chapter 1 of Isaiah, he says this, "Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. Sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its master's manger. But Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Alas, sinful nation, people weighed down with iniquity. Offspring of evildoers, sons who act corruptly, they have abandoned the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from him." Do you notice how he describes his people? In verse 3, he says that Israel does not know. They do not understand. He likens it to an ox will know its owner and a donkey will know the master's manger. So beasts will know who their owner is. And yet my people don't recognize that I am their God. They reject me. They turn away. They have despised me. And you know from your very brief introduction to Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, what does disobedience bring? Punishment. When they reject, when they turn, when they say, no, we don't want you, Holy One of Israel, well, you know that trouble's a brewing, so to speak. I wish we had the time to really look at the first five chapters of Isaiah because they do set the stage. They, in a sense, set the table for Isaiah's call in chapter 6. We'll briefly go through it, but I encourage you to read 1 through 5 on your own. Here we have God rejects Israel's worship because of sin, and he considers it worthless. In chapter 1, 11 through 15, in 1:21, Jerusalem is compared to a harlot. The nation has worshipped idols. Their sin is likened to Sodom's sin. Not a favorable comparison. Even the women are condemned for their sin in 3:16 to 25. In chapter 5, at the end, they have rejected God's law and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel, and God is going to judge. In chapter 5, go ahead and turn to chapter 5. We'll look at the end of chapter 5. But I'm going to set up the stage, so to speak. There's a parable of a vineyard. Interestingly enough, Jesus will use the same parable in the Gospel of Matthew, but there's a parable of a vineyard, and God is seen as having established this vineyard. He has done everything possible to provide for the vineyard to grow. He has tilled it. He has protected it. He has even given and planted the best plants in this vineyard, and he expects it to produce really, really choice grapes. And they produce worthless grapes. So he says, I'm going to just destroy this vineyard. It's producing worthlessness. And then Isaiah says, Israel and Judah, you are that vineyard. And then six times in chapter 5, it's going to say, woe to those who are wicked, to those who are this, to those who are that. And when the prophets say woe, it's not a like, whoa, like, check that out. Whoa. When woe happens, watch out, because judgment is coming. Woe, woe, woe. Six times woe is pronounced as judgment against the nations. Why? They've rejected the Holy One. Look at verse 24, at the end of verse 24. They rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Down in verse 26, he will also lift up a standard to the distant nation and whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. So basically, Isaiah is going to end chapter 5 with the nation is going to be judged, and they're going to be judged with exile. As you've seen Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, they are going to have promises fulfilled to them, just not the promises that they want, because they've rejected the Holy One. They have despised the word of the Holy One. Then we get into chapter 6. And in chapter 6, it's the call of Isaiah, and you understand immediately once you get to chapter 6 why he put chapters 1 through 5 in the front. He's established this judgment upon the nations. And then we see the call of Isaiah. It's probably one of the most popular chapters in Isaiah. And it's amazing to see that in the environment that Isaiah is in, King Uzziah has died in verse 1. King Uzziah is a king who's reigned for about 52 years. He became king at age 16. And his reign is basically a prosperous reign. They grow militarily. They have lots and lots of economic prosperity. Things are going along fine. In fact, King Uzziah is following God very well for most of his life, and yet at the very end of his life, he becomes proud in his heart, and he disobeys God's commandments and is struck with leprosy and ends up dying from leprosy. But while the nation is prosperous, while the nation is economically booming, they're also spiritually bankrupt. They have rejected God. They have despised him. And Isaiah is going to be called to minister for roughly about 50 years. Over the span of four kings, he's going to be called to minister, and he's going to be called to proclaim a message, and no one will listen. And yet he's faithful. Faithful to the point that by the time Manasseh comes around, Manasseh kills him. I think Isaiah 6, and there's a lot of fascinating things about Isaiah 6, I think Isaiah 6 is going to help us understand why he was faithful. I think there's some significant aspects in his calling that will help us as well. The messenger of the King of Kings. The first point that we're going to look at is the messenger worships the King of Kings. Probably one of the most fascinating visions of God in chapter 6, 1 through 7, and I'll read it. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on the throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. Then I said, "Woe is me, for I am a man ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." It is no coincidence that Isaiah begins chapter 6 with, "In the year King Uzziah died," who did he see? He saw the King. There is a direct connection between when Uzziah died, the king, the human king of Israel, Isaiah sees a vision of the King of Kings. He sees this amazing picture of God ruling on the throne. You think about it, uncertain times were ahead for Israel. Their decent king has died. Ahaz is down the road, and he's going to be king in a few years, and he's probably one of the worst kings. There's tumultuous times. Economically, things seem to be okay, but things are starting to head south, and spiritually, people have rejected God. And Isaiah, who's called in the ministry in the year that the human king died, sees the divine king. Look at how he describes him. "I saw the Lord, Adonai." It's usually translated master. It's a sovereign master. "I saw the Lord sitting on the throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple." One of the things that Isaiah needed, first and foremost, to help him as he begins in his ministry, as he begins to go and preach a message that won't be popular, is a renewed vision of the King. And that's the aspect that we see here, a renewed vision of the King. In order to be promoted or to promote this faithfulness, his whole mind and concept of God needs to be renewed about who God really is. Who's in control? Even as sin is abounding in the nations, who is in control? Is it the kings or is it the King of Kings? "I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted." It speaks of this idea that God, on his throne, is ruling, judging, in control, and sovereign. Well, what better idea to encourage a messenger for the king than to show that king actually is in control of all the events, even around them? Isaiah sees the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted. Notice the end of verse 1, "with the train of his robe filling the temple." I just find this fascinating. It literally is the hem of the robe, the little tiny hem. You know what a hem is? You know what a hem is. You pull them and your whole shirt comes off, you know, that kind of thing, right? The hem on the robe of the king is filling the temple. You understand the temple is a pretty big place, right? I mean, it's pretty huge. And this vision that Isaiah sees of the king is one in which the robe's not filling the temple. The hem, the thread on the garment at the bottom of the robe is filling the temple. Is that a big view of God or a small view of God? What do you think? When you see that, is that a big view of God? Does he see God as high and exalted and lifted up and this vision shaking him to the foundation, so to speak? We see this in other biblical accounts of visions of God. When Ezekiel, when he's face to face with a vision of God, this is amazing vision of who God is, and he becomes face to face in the dirt. Peter, when he recognizes Jesus as the King of Kings, as the Holy One, falls to his face and says, "Depart me, for I am a sinner." John, in the book of Revelation, John had walked with Jesus for years, and when he'd seen the glory of the risen King in the book of Revelation, he fell on his face and worshiped. Over and over, we see this renewed vision of the King. One of the things that I am intrigued with is the seraphim in verse 2. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. So the picture here is of these types of beings that are around the throne, and they have six wings, and they're doing something with all of their wings. And seraphim literally means the burning ones. Now, why are they burning? I don't know. I think what's interesting is that the burning ones, the seraphim, take a burning coal and touch the lips of Isaiah. Were they on fire? Were they glowing from the presence of the King? We're not sure. It's the only time that they're mentioned in the Old Testament. We do know that they're some type of angelic beings. Daniel 7, verse 10, tells us that on the throne, with God reigning, there are thousands and thousands of angels attending him, serving him, and 10,000s times 10,000s ready to serve. And what Daniel shows us a picture of is that around the throne of God, there are hundreds and hundreds and thousands and millions of angels ready to serve at any moment. And these angels in particular, these seraphim, they're covering their eyes. Now, I can understand Isaiah saying, woe is me, when he sees the holiness of God, because he's a sinful man. But why do these angelic beings, who aren't fallen angels, they're angels, why are they covering their face? Through worship. Even the seraphim see the glory and the majesty of the King. They cover their face. With two, they cover their feet, most likely symbolizing humility in their service. Now, picture this. They have feet, they have faces, they have hands, they have mouths to talk, they have wings covering their face, they have wings covering their feet, and wings that are flying. It might be like a hummingbird, so to speak, hovering, ready to serve. And what do? Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, whose the whole earth is full of his glory. Three times they sing, holy, holy, holy. Now, some take this to show that it's the Trinity here. That may or may not be. I believe the Old Testament does talk specifically about the Trinity in terms of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. But I do know this, that when Hebrew is used and it's repeated, it's for emphasis. When Hebrew is repeated three times, it signifies completeness. You have in Ezekiel 21, in which Ezekiel is talking about the destruction of the land, and he says, ruin, ruin, ruin. And he's pointing to utter, complete destruction. And so when the seraphim are in front of the King of Kings, they're saying, holy, holy, holy. This King is completely holy, transcendent, pure, awesome. And they're worshiping. One of the things that I find even more fascinating about chapter 6 is who they're worshiping. For the Gospel of John tells us that this is the pre-incarnate Christ. Jesus Christ, King of Kings, sitting on the throne in the Old Testament, and Isaiah sees him. That's pretty cool. And you say, prove it to me. Okay, I will. Isaiah 6. In John 12:41, these things Isaiah said because he saw his glory and he spoke of him. The context of John chapter 12 is Jesus is performing miracles and people are not believing in him. They're rejecting him. And so Jesus quotes Isaiah and he says these fulfill the word of Isaiah, chapter 6, verses 9 and 10. So he quotes our chapter in chapter 6. And then John notes these things Isaiah said because he saw his glory, Jesus Christ, and he spoke of him. Isaiah, in a sense, probably could be relabeled the gospel of Isaiah. There is so much about Jesus Christ in the book of Isaiah, it will overwhelm you as you study it. It's amazing what is in there. We don't have time to go through all of it, but I do want to hit some highlights of Isaiah 6 and how they speak, how it speaks of Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. In Isaiah 7:14, a virgin will give birth to a son, and she will call him Emmanuel, God with us. Matthew chapter 1 quotes this as being fulfilled in Jesus Christ. In Isaiah 9:6-7, a son born will rule on David's throne forever. And Luke chapter 1 shows us this son who will rule forever is Jesus Christ. We have Isaiah 11:1-10, a righteous ruler, the stem of Jesse, will rule over the nations and bring peace. And pretty much from cover to cover of the Old Testament and New Testament, we see this will take place in the millennial kingdom. And then Isaiah 52:13-53:12, one of the most popular, the suffering servant will be exalted and lifted up after he suffers for sin. The New Testament overwhelmingly attributes this to Jesus Christ. The interesting thing that I find is that exalted and lifted up are the same words that we see in chapter 6 of the Lord sitting on the throne, high and lifted up. Here's some interesting theology. In chapter 6, we have Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, pre-incarnate, sitting on the throne. Isaiah sees his glory. And the next chapter, we have the promise of the incarnation, that the King of Kings will condescend and be born a man. In Isaiah 53, he will suffer for sins and be our guilt offering. So much about this, I think, is amazing, but the fact that Isaiah sees Jesus Christ in all his glory reminds us of John chapter 17 when Jesus talks about his glory that he shared with the Father before the world even began. He sees this high and exalted vision of God, the holiness, the authority, the King of Kings. Do you think this impacted Isaiah a little? Do you think this encounter with the Holy One of Israel impacted him? The holiness aspect is a theme that Isaiah will carry through the rest of the book. 29 times he uses his most common and favorite title of God, the Holy One. This was ingrained in his mind as he begins his ministry of being a faithful messenger. The biggest impact, the biggest aspect that Isaiah needed was a renewed vision of his King. To see God exalted, and then we're going to see in consequence, and him humbled and lowered. That's the second aspect of it, is a renewed vision of the King and a right understanding of yourself. Verse 5, then I said, woe is me, for I am ruined. Now up to this point, Isaiah hasn't said anything in this encounter. He's describing it, but he hasn't said anything. And the first thing out of his mouth is very similar to chapter 5. Woe, 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 judgment upon Israel for their sins. And he realizes immediately, woe is me. I am undone. I am a man ruined. Because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Isaiah is going to come face to face with the stark reality of who he is before a holy God. I really am fascinated with reading or hearing different accounts of people's visions of Jesus Christ. I don't know if you are. I actually enjoy reading it in some extent. It kind of irritates me and infuriates me in other ways. I know of this one man who claims while he was shaving, he saw Jesus in the mirror. And he began to discuss these things of his life with Jesus in the mirror shaving. He didn't stop shaving. He kept shaving as he was dialoguing with Jesus about how his life should go. Another person indicated that they were sitting on a park bench and they looked over and lo and behold, Jesus was right there. Kind of similar to Forrest Gump and sitting on the bench and type of things. And Jesus appears and gives insightful instructions on the choices this person needs to make. And you hear about or you read about different visions of Jesus Christ, and most of them, if not all of them, tend to be Jesus is my buddy. It's the Jesus is my buddy theology. And yet, biblically, when we see people face to face with the King of Kings, the glorious one, the Holy One, they're humbled. And they fall on their face, and some even are terrified that they are undone. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus isn't our friend. I would sing with the hymnist, "What a friend we have in Jesus." But I would add to that, and that friend is the King of Kings, the Holy One, the Righteous, the Majestic, the Amazing God of the universe. And when you think about it, if you have a high view of yourself, and I would say we all do, if you have a high view of yourself, you're going to have a low view of God. The two can't sustain each other mutually. A high view of God means a correct view of yourself, and oftentimes being a faithful messenger is linked hand in hand with how you view the King of Kings. Because if you view the King of Kings as just merely your friend, maybe the person who gave you the get out of eternal punishment card free of charge, if you view him as that and just only that, and fail to see him as the King of Kings, holy, majestic, and awesome, oftentimes it's going to lead to apathy in our lives, and myself included. When you look and you tear open your heart, so to speak, and take a good look at it, oftentimes you'll see a low view of God connected to a high view of self, resulting in why you do the things you do, or don't do the things you should do. A messenger of the king is only going to be as good as his vision of that king. If you had a king and you're like, my king is pretty cool. Yeah, you know, he's cool. I enjoy him. And he says, go. And you say, when I can, I'll go. For Isaiah, the key to his success, so to speak, I believe, continued with his constant reflection of an exalted view of God. And that's hard. I ask myself, it's a heavy message to preach, because in essence, it's the heal thyself physician type of thing, and you lay open your heart and you ask the Lord, where am I independent? Where am I? Yeah, this, I'm the king in my life type of thing, and it's ugly to see. Ask yourself this question, day by day, moment by moment, what is your view of Jesus Christ? Do you see him as high and lifted up, exalted, the king over you and who has sent you? And imagine living a life in which time after time after time, people reject the message that you have from the king. It would be discouraging after a while. And the only thing that Isaiah has rooted is the fact that he has a high view of the king, holy, lofty, and exalted. The seraphim take the coal and he puts it on his lips and he's forgiven of his sins in verses 6 to 7. Isaiah didn't do anything except for confess his sinfulness. And we get to verse 8, and we see this. He's gearing up for service. The messenger of the King of Kings serves the kings. I think it's important to note the flow of thought. Isaiah sees God. He sees himself in light of God. He recognizes his sin. He's forgiven of his sin. Then he's sent to go. And we have verse 8 here. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here I am. Send me." Isaiah is a man of few words in chapter 6. "Woe is me, send me." Verse 11, we'll see how long. It's pretty much the gist of his conversations. "Woe is me," he's forgiven. The God of the universe, the King of Kings, looks around and says, "Who will I send? Who will go for us?" And then Isaiah says, "Here I am, send me." Now remember, he's just admitted that he is a man of unclean lips and he lives among a people of unclean lips. And in this vision, he is the only one that has experienced the forgiveness. And so you have to wonder, when God asks the question, "Who shall I send? Who will go for us?" I wonder if he looked around. I don't know, the text doesn't say. Some people, and this is a good missions commissioning message, some people might think, "Who shall I send? Who will go for us?" And then you see Isaiah, "Here am I! Send me!" For a man that just thought, "Woe is me, I am undone," the humility, I think, continues where he realizes that he needs to go. He is willing to go. Now, verse 8 has a lot that it says, but I think it has a lot that it doesn't say. And notice that God doesn't say, "Who is interested in going to Hawaii and sharing the gospel on the beaches of Hawaii or any other romantic place you can think of?" I don't know what you would consider romantic. I like Italy, and I'm a big Rome fan. And who would go for us to eat pasta in Rome and minister to the people there? And you also don't see Isaiah saying, "Well, Lord, I'm interested in these places, but I'm not interested in these things. Lord, as long as, you know, the money's good and the things are actually fruitful and these things are happening, yeah, I think I'd be willing to go." He asked the simple question, "Who shall I send? Who will go for us?" And literally it says, "Behold, look, here I am. Send me." You have to really be amazed that Isaiah didn't ask, where am I going and for how long initially? What am I going to say? What's it going to be like? Are people going to like me? Is it going to be successful? Am I going to enjoy it? Is it going to be something in which I can invite other friends along for? He says, "Who will I send? Send me." And so what you have here is this idea of willingness to do what the king wants. Who will go for us? Whom will I send? Send me. Where? Send me anywhere. The second thing you see here is this, is that an understanding that he was sent. If you say, "I'll go," then maybe there's an instance in which then you can stop when you want to. I mean, some people might think it's not a big deal. I think it's a big deal that the word "send me" is there. the idea that he is being sent. He's not going and saying, I'm going to go, and when it gets hard, I'm going to stop. He understands that he is sent from the king. I mean, how many people would snub their nose up at the most powerful man in the world, humanly speaking? I don't know who that would be, but let's make up one. The most powerful man in the world, and he says, will you go and do this? And most people would say, yeah, I'm going to do that. Here you have God, the sovereign God of the universe, send me, understanding that he is sent. Now, most sermons end there. We'll keep going until the end of the chapter. But that's a good ending for a lot of missions commissioning services, right? A renewed vision of God. Understand who you're going to be a messenger for. Knowing that you're moving into service and you're going to go. Like, you're willing. You're ready to go. And that, I probably have heard that a number of times in commissioning or missions-minded sermons. And very rarely do you read 9 through 13, which, when you put it all together, you have this. Isaiah has a vision of God. It humbles him. He sees his sinfulness. He's ready to go anywhere. He's ready to do anything. And God says, now go to these people. They're not going to listen. They're not going to listen. They're not going to understand. Even though you're speaking to them, they're not going to respond. Verse 11, he says, how long? That's a natural question, right? How long? Until cities are devastated. That is an intriguing answer to his question. He understands that he needs to proclaim the king, or in this particular instance, proclaims the king's message, regardless of if anybody responds or not. Now let's look at verses 9 and 10. He said, go and tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull, their eyes dim. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed. And here you have speaking no matter the response. You have Isaiah having been transformed by his understanding of who God is, knowing that God is high and exalted, he is low and sinful, yet forgiven. He's willing to go, and God tells him, you're going to speak, and no one is going to listen. And in the context of his ministry, probably some 50 years. Keep on listening, but do not perceive. Back in chapter 1, we read it, but I think it's important. Chapter 1, verse 3, we have a description of these people. But Israel does not know. The Hebrew there is yada. I believe that it's where we get yada, yada, yada. But don't quote me on that. But Israel does not know, yada. My people do not understand. Ben is the Hebrew word there. So when you go to chapter 6, verse 9, there's an interesting play on words here. Keep on listening, but do not perceive, or Ben. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Yada. Then in verse 10, it literally says, render their hearts fat, their ears heavy, their eyes smeared. It has this picture of a calloused, hardened heart, ears that are heavy and blocked, and eyes that are smeared over. And the natural question arises, why doesn't God want them to turn back? I mean, I've thought that that's what God would want. He would want repentance, right? He would want them to turn back to him. And when you understand the timeline of this, and you understand through the eyes of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, they have continued to sin. They have continued to rebel. They do not know. They do not perceive because of their rejection. And God is going to judge them, and they will continue to not know and not perceive. And they'll continue to be hardened. Why? Because God's going to be faithful to his promises. He is going to judge, and he's going to exile them. That's a difficult message. Imagine for 50 years, you're going to proclaim exile to a nation. Verse 11. Here we have, speak no matter the difficulty. Verse 11, then he said, Lord, how long? And he answered, until cities are devastated and without inhabitation, houses are without people, and the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away. Now, if you go and study Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, you'll see the exact same phrases here. Punishment in rejecting God will in turn bring the promise of a desolated country. Devastated cities. No one will be left. Verse 12, the Lord has removed men far away. The forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. When we get to verse 11 and 12, we understand why that's happening in light of the Torah. In verse 13, yet. I love that little word, yet. It is a powerful word because here we have a ray of hope in Isaiah's message. Yet there will be a tenth portion in it, and it will again be subject to burning. Like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains when it is felled, the holy seed is its stump. So God is telling Isaiah, go tell these people, you're going to continually hear the preaching of the word, but you're not going to be spiritually changed. In fact, you're going to become more hard to it. And that's judgment based on the promises God has already made. However, God has made other promises in the same context, that after judgment, after exile, God will in the future restore Israel. And this is that promise. Though a tenth portion remained in the land, and if you read 2 Kings, you'll see when Israel and when Judah are taken away, Judah in particular, when it's exiled, the only people that are left in the land are poor people. And then even then, people come in and those poor people end up being killed. This is the vision of that. A tenth portion, a remnant will remain, but even that remnant will be subject to burning. However, like a terebinth or like a tree that's been chopped, the stump remains, and yet even though that stump has been burned, something significant will spring forth from that stump. It's a vision, it's a picture of God's future restoration, that even though God will judge, and part of his judgment is hardening, and part of his judgment is exiling them into the land, or out of the land, even though he will do that, he will still be faithful to restore them back. And here's the thing that I find fascinating. The stump remains. In Isaiah 11, a shoot from Jesse will spring forth. Jesus Christ. You know that most people probably don't enjoy reading genealogies here, I would bet. Like if you start to read so-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so, and you're like, wait, you lost me at the second begat. I'm not sure what's going on here. I encourage you to read Matthew 1, the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Matthew arranges it in sections. And that genealogy, interestingly enough, the middle section is how God preserved his remnant in Babylon, which would ultimately come out in Jesus Christ. That's amazing. When we open up the book of Isaiah and we see his life, Isaiah comes face to face with God and he has a renewed vision. He understands who he is in light of God. He understands his sinfulness. He also understands the fact that he is the servant, God is the king. He is not king of his life. He is not going to and fro wherever he wants to go. God is on the throne, and he will be sent, and he will be faithful. And I bet you, even in the tough times, Isaiah looked back to his magnificent vision of Jesus Christ. Holy, holy, holy. And for you and I, when we get into opportunities to go places, to do things, to at work be an example, to go down to Mexico for a loft ministry, to go on a short-term mission trip, to go out in the field, to be a member missionary even in this environment, to talk to our neighbors. What an encouragement in the faithfulness of Isaiah. And what a challenge. And I bet, because it's true in my own life, when you're apathetic to that, it's usually because of a high view of self and a low view of God. Your life, your agenda, your purposes, rather than to say, I'll go wherever. I'll speak what you want me to speak, even if no one listens. And ultimately, family, our lack is because of our lack of an exalted view of God. And I struggle with that. I don't know if you do. Maybe you say, every day I view Jesus Christ as King, holy, 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 and glorious. I look at my life and I deal with my own pride and I deal with my own apathy and I deal with all of the things that are before me. And this section, Isaiah 6, is a refreshment. It's a challenge. It sure is convicting. And to deal with that, I think, is of utmost priority. Let's pray. God, thank you for your word and for the call of Isaiah and just a reminder to be faithful. And in that reminder to be faithful, to have a high view of you, to see Christ as the King of Kings, exalted, lifted up, our King who sends us. Maybe we be willing to go wherever, whenever, however. In your son's name, amen. Have a great Sunday.